This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to No Bad Ideas, a storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
Goodness of stories, not guaranteed. Badness of ideas, very much guaranteed.
Or your money back.
No, there's no money back.
I'm Gabriel Urbina, one of your co-hosts.
My name is Sarah Shackett.
And I'm Zach Valenti.
And today we are fortunate enough to be joined by an amazing guest here at No Bad Ideas HQ. We have with us the editor at large at Vox and the co-creator of the podcast Autodrama Arden, Mr. Todd Vanderwerf.
It's so great to be here. Sadly, I'm just the critic at large. Oh. Someday they'll make me an editor at large.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. Oh my God. Fine. It's just a title. Who really cares? But you talking about the money back, like I tried to put that in a tweet at Vox for like an article. It was like, if you don't like this article, you'll get your money back. And like, they made me take it out because they were like, they didn't want me to get it. I was like, Twitter is free. But you know.
I'm just saying. People think they can get their money back. They cannot.
Well, it is an absolute pleasure and a real honor to have you here with us.
It's great to be here. I love the show.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you are joining us for the first time, we should talk about what the show is. So once a week, we all get together and one of us brings in an idea from the world at large that is...
A reasonable idea?
No. A bad idea, just something that you kind of go, that is so needlessly dangerous or ill-conceived or misguided or immoral, just something that in some definition of the words makes you go, my God, somebody had a bad idea that day. And we present that to the rest of the team, and then everyone has 30 minutes to figure out a way to turn that into a good story, or to try to at least, to come as close as possible. And this week, I have the dubious honor, but great, great pleasure to be able to bring the bad idea to the team. And I'm so excited. Aren't you guys excited?
Yes.
Hooray!
I've never been here before, so I don't know.
I'm excited for you to be here. I'm terrified of what you're about to unleash on us.
Oh, come on, Zach.
He has that Cheshire Cat grin. That's always a...
It's good sign.
It's a sign.
It's going to be great. Why don't we get into it? Let's not ado any further.
Where does this bad idea come from, Gabriel?
From National Public Radio. The good folks at NPR are our purveyors of bad ideas du jour. And listeners, if you go into the episode's description in your podcast feed, you'll be able to find a description. In the description, you'll be able to find a link to the article if you'd like to read along. So, our bad idea of the week. The article's headline, need fake friends for your wedding? In South Korea, you can hire them.
Okay.
The article begins. Weddings and baby showers are real-life milestones to spend with your actual loved ones. True, but in South Korea, a cottage industry exists to help real people find fake friends to fill seats at such life rituals. At a recent wedding in June, Kim Se-yeon showed up as a guest, even though she's a total stranger to the bride and groom. She makes about $20 per wedding she attends as a pretend friend. When it's the peak wedding season in Korea, sometimes I do two or three acts a day, every weekend, Kim says.
Wow.
As a role player, she's part of an agency that casts her to attend weddings all over the country. At this wedding, at least 30 of the guests are getting paid to fill the seats. It's fun! A lot of the time, couples need these guests because they want to save face, Kim says. They're conscious of what others think, and they need more friends.
Who are they saving face from?
We'll get to that, I think. So the brides are very thankful for my presence. At this particular ceremony, neither the bride, who hired Kim, nor the groom, who doesn't even know there are fake guests at this wedding, noticed an NPR reporter in the crowd. I suppose you could call it wedding crashing, but I just blended right in with the other unfamiliar faces. The logic in South Korea is this. You can rent chairs and venues for weddings. Why not guests? Wedding guest rental started in the late 1990s, and in the early 2000s, broader role-playing rentals began, says Lee Hyun-soo. He runs a South Korean casting agency called Role Rental 119. He keeps a database of 2,000 actors ages 21 to 70 whom he places to work in real-life situations. We're talking fake bosses, fake parents, fake mistresses. Lee has cast them all. This year, we've seen increases in the other types of rental requests, like renting family members, boyfriends, girlfriends, lovers, or office employees. There have also been times when people hired fake spouses to get loans from the bank, Lee says. This continues onwards for a little bit, but I think that you guys get the...
Is there any more context about why, in South Korea specifically, this is a thing?
So there is a little...
There I mean, is, their internet is faster than ours. I believe that, like, they will be ahead of us.
There is a little bit more in the article about it, and it kind of comes down to culturally, there is a lot of value assignation to how you are doing relative to your peers.
Got it.
So it's kind of one of those where if you get married and 30 people show up to your guest, but then Bob gets married and 50 people show up to their wedding, then... There's a little bit of
there,
a problem.
There was a similar wave of stories a couple of years ago about you could rent a boyfriend or girlfriend in Japan. Like if you were going to go to a family reunion or something and wanted to show off. So
yeah, this brought to mind, you should start a timer
I'm going to start the timer. You have 30 minutes starting now.
But there's like that whole industry in Japan of, you know, going to a club and basically like having... conversation with someone who's paid to talk to you.
And I'll tell you, the thing that I found possibly particularly sinister about this story when I was looking up possibilities for today was the idea that the groom at this wedding would not know.
Right.
Right.
That the bride would hire guests to be at the wedding and the groom would think that everyone was there was like dear, close, intimate friends.
Yeah. Oh, man. Do you guys remember a couple of years? I don't even know how long ago it was because time has warped. I've been on Twitter. but there was this thing that went viral about like a groom ending up running away like with one of the bridesmaids. And then one of the other bridesmaids was like, tweeting everything that the bride was doing to like cut off his bank account, and like they had a party for her anyway. It was like this really dramatic thing. Imagine if that happened with someone who was paid to be there. That's my first thought. But I don't know, man. This could go in so many different directions.
I am a real connoisseur of the paid to fake some sort of relationship genre of romantic comedy and or, you know, romantic drama. For example, The Wedding Date starring Deborah Messing, in which she pays a handsome man to be her date to the wedding. And
that's right.
Then, of course, they fall in love. So this, you know, the easy thing to do, the like, we're just going downhill is like, this is somewhere in the vicinity of that. But it feels too easy to me.
Yeah. No, there's, what was that awful film a couple years ago? Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates?
Yeah.
That's what's popped in my mind. And I'm like, no, we can get weirder than that. I'm not quite sure how, though.
I mean, there's also The Game.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard enough about it.
This is similar to as well. So,
right.
And it opens up at the end with sort of this agency that has cast fake bosses and
fake spouses for like for bank financial loans. Purposes.
Yeah. You'd think banks would have better processes. You're like, are they checking ID?
I don't know.
I guess they're just running your identification, and it's the impression you make.
Is there not a database of like married? Yes, no. I don't know.
I don't know.
But this is also what was the come back to me. There's a reference that that popped. Oh, Dollhouse.
Mm-hmm.
That's
sure.
Vaguely, like, yeah. That's like the darker sci-fi twist where you're getting these like blank humans with like personality installs that that are so convincing, even you buy it.
Mm. Right.
Hmm.
But yeah, but so we're going to put aside kind of something as simple as two people that are hired to go to this wedding end up kind of having to pretend to be dates.
Right.
And then sort of slowly actually have a real date in the middle of their pretend date,
right.
Kind of before sunrise style.
Hmm. So we're saying that's low hanging fruit.
We're going to take that off the table as too simple,
at
too
least
straightforward.
For now.
Okay.
We can come back to it if in 10 minutes we got nothing.
I almost feel like the game, the Truman Show version of it is also too right there. You mm-hmm. know, like,
yeah.
like you mm-hmm. need, you need to make it a higher bar, I think. So, but I'm thinking on that.
That was a thought that I had of kind of just maximize this
right.
and just kind of blow it up. And it's not just the wedding that is all fake people, but it's this person somehow discovers that everyone that he's friends with, like, you know, his job he only has because somebody hired them to kind of create this fake company for him to work at.
Right.
All his friends have been hired.
It's
by
some kind of social experiment or television
or,
program.
You know, right. or his like Tywin Lannister of a dad is just kind of
yeah.
like, no son of mine is going to fail.
Like, this is how you're groomed for political office, is just like the artifice of, you know, working at a law firm that's very fake, except you're learning lessons or something.
Or he's a sim, like he's in the
right.
video game The Sims and like realizes all of his stuff has been created for him by Will Wright and or an ambitious computer programmer.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Isn't that spoilers, I guess. Isn't that like what Serenity, the method?
Yes.
Isn't that what that's doing?
The climax of that movie is that he discovers he's a character in a fishing game and somebody is trying to break the programming of the game to make him kill someone. I mean, if
God.
I explain the plot of this movie, we're going to eat up the rest of
that
our
is
time.
What we're
yeah. yeah. No, but yeah, I had that. I have not seen it, but I had that spoiled for me.
This is that new movie.
Yeah, with Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey.
Trust me, having it spoiled somehow makes it better. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah. There you go, nobody is listeners. You're welcome.
You're welcome. Oh, man, this is like the first time I've sort of been really stumped on a direction to go.
And I feel
there's so many directions
sure.
that we could go.
Well, let me ask us, whose perspective are we from? Are we from the guy? Are we from the bride? Are we from one of the fake friends? Are we from, you know, the minister?
Well, that, right. That's a choice. And I'm kind of curious, like, what story could we tell? Like, when I think about that Truman Show world and sort of that kind of a setup.
Yeah.
Like, what are the people's, like, the super background characters' lives like? Like,
right.
did they meet somebody, at, like, on set and, like, start to have a relationship and they had to go to HR and then they, like, HR
oh, man, it's
started,
like, that,
like, rewriting
the
their
one
script
awkward
so
subplot
they could date
in Love Actually
in real
with Martin Freeman, where, like, he has a genuine relationship with someone, but it's on set having a sex scene. And I wonder if there's maybe something, again, this all sort of feels like low hanging fruit. But like two people who have to do something very, very intense, they're hired to do it. And then it spurs either a rivalry or a romance, or something in real life.
I'm kind of drawn to the bride. I'm kind of drawn to the idea of this being all that jazz, but planning a wedding and like trying to get everything exactly right. And
right.
like her slow descent into madness.
Oh, sure.
This is, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I like that idea of like first 10 minutes of the film, if it is a film, somebody's kind of going like, oh, hey, have you heard about this service? Because like, and she's sort of going, I would never, that is so beneath me.
Right.
And then 40 minutes of disasters later, all of a sudden it's like, oh, God damn it. You know, she's picking up the phone and calling them being like, you know, I want five people. And then it's like, you know, you sure? Because like, we could give you like 10 for only 25% more payments. She's like, all right. Better make it 10.
And then you could stay really comedic or you could twist it kind of dark horror, like maybe somebody she hires is somebody who's been stalking her. That's the insane twist.
Right.
Or it's just like she randomly hires a serial killer, you know, like something like that. So
or she hires these people for a wedding. The wedding happens. She goes on her honeymoon. She comes back. And then the people are still there in her life. Yes. All of a sudden, someone is showing up. Right. One of the actors at the wedding is showing up for, come on, we're going jogging. Like, you know, we always go jogging at 6 a.m. And it's kind of this like, no, we don't. We really, really don't. But I can't. But I haven't told my spouse. I don't. All right, I guess I'm going jogging with you. And it's kind of this, like, how long does this contract run for?
Right.
And like, are you getting billed for it? Like, is this like a situation where the company then bilks you because you like didn't read the fine print and you now have a friend for life at the low, low cost of your entire savings?
Right.
Or is there like a mysterious benefactor who's just like funding your social life in a way that you don't want, but you can't say no to because you'll be caught in a lie?
Right. Or it's sort of starting to slowly warp your social life. Like maybe this is someone whose mother forced them to use the service because no daughter of mine is going to have only 40 people at their wedding. That's ridiculous. And she's like, okay, I would get married in the courthouse. But for you, Mom, I will use this service. And then the service sticks around and makes...
Right, all of a sudden she's going to different bars because she has different friends. And all of a sudden she doesn't have time to hang out with that guy that she really likes who's in that punk rock band.
Right.
Like all of a sudden, or like very subtly, her life is getting molded into something different.
Yes, and that takes it into like Truman Show-ish territory, but more Hitchcockian in a way that I think... might be interesting.
Have any of you guys ever seen, I think it's a John Frankenheimer movie, Seconds?
I have heard of it and not seen it.
Long, long ago, yeah.
But it's kind of something like this, of like a guy makes a bargain with a shadowy organization to get a new life. And he thinks that what he's getting is kind of this blank slate. And it turns out that what he's getting is an invitation to step into this hyper-specific role that they had designed for him.
Hmm.
And the moment that he's not following exactly what he's supposed to do, then there's really bad trouble.
Well, if it's a tension between her mother, with her mother has always been like, I don't like you being this iconoclastic punk type, whatever, then maybe the tension is also her husband liked that. And
right.
Like now she's slowly being dragged into this other life she doesn't want to be in. She might lose him, et cetera, et cetera. Like I think there's room to run there, you know?
Yeah, and you have to sort of make a choice between honesty and appearances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How's this for a slight twist on what we've got so far?
Mm.
So it's not her mother. It's her spouse's mother.
Gotcha.
That suggests the service. And she's sort of telling her, you know, we're going to keep this a secret from your fiancé. He would flip out, but...
And this is that woman's son.
That woman's son,
right,
yes.
Right, right.
So we're going to keep this a secret from the son. We're going to keep this, you know, he's never going to know, but like we're going to do this, and we're going to hire some people to come to this wedding. For whatever reason, she gets talked into it.
Right.
And then everything starts to go wrong. The people don't leave. She's being forced into this different life. And at a certain point, I don't know if she maybe goes by the agency that did this in secret, but once she's there, she sees the woman that she has been introduced to as her husband's mother.
Yeah.
And she's there and she is one of the performers for this thing. And that's when she realized that, wait a minute.
How deep does this go?
And like, was it my husband that kicked this whole thing off? Does he sort of have this, you know, sort of crazy web of designs? Was it someone else? Does this go higher? Does this go lower? Where does it end?
Yeah, I dig that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess we have to decide where it does end, or sort of dig more into the characters a bit.
Yeah. That was going to be my next question of just kind of who is
the protagonist? I mean, at this rate, it seemed like with what was just said, it feels like the fiance, the wife in the couple is sort of put in that, like, kind of like that Get Out situation.
Yeah.
Sure.
Just like this weird family is being weird. And maybe to, you know, not such great ends. I don't know.
As the whitest human being alive, I'm just going to say this, yeah, and then we're going to back away from it. But like, there is an element where you could do social commentary on race or gender or something like that. But also, very white human being, going to back away from that. But somebody else, go for it.
Right. And I was about to say, like, maybe let's move it to the States.
I think that definitely makes it a little bit more engageable for the four people in this room. And I imagine that it's probably happening in a space kind of like the game space. Like at least one of them being a very wealthy family.
My wife talks about this a lot because we are childless. We're from the small town Midwest. All of our high school friends have kids, have big houses in like small towns in South Dakota. We have a nice apartment, but not like a big house. And like, there's sort of that tension between like the life we thought we were going to lead growing up there and the life we actually lead, and like how hard it is to let go of that even when you know you don't want it. And I think that that's kind of the emotional conflict we can explore, is like letting go of the thing you thought you wanted, even after you've learned you don't.
And
getting sucked into that.
Yeah, that's interesting, bringing in sort of like the peer pressure-ness of it. Maybe this is someone from a smaller town or from a town where people got married a lot earlier in life. And they have, for whatever reason, moved to a big urban space. They are getting married rather later. Has, you know, a nice life, but like very, very different. And for whatever reason, they're going to get married back in that like small town space. And so it needs to look a certain way. And then maybe that's the motivation to use the service.
15 minutes, by the way, halfway all through the time.
That's time.
We're great.
Yeah.
We're golden.
No. And then you could have like the protagonist sort of struggling with, oh, there are some nice things about this. But then, you know, as sort of the conspiracy develops, realizing that, no, they walked away from this for a reason, and the expectations that they have, you know, it's okay to let them go. And so I would imagine in this case, maybe it's like not their entire life has been engineered by this, what is Rossum Corporation is the company in Dollhouse?
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe it's something that, you know, they have to, I'm moving us away from the thriller place, and I'm talking and I'm having a conflict about it because I thought thriller was really cool. But, you know, it could be more sort of like a domestic dramedy where they sort of have to back out of this.
I mean, everything that I pitch eventually turns into a small scale character drama. So like, you could be set in space and we'd end up there. So, but yeah, I think that's a way to go with it.
I think that there's also something to deciding what the anxiety at the heart of this is. Because there's a version of this that is, oh God, I married someone that I thought saw me for who I am and for what I want to be. And instead, now that I'm with him, I am getting chipped away into this thing that they want me to be. And that's one way to go about it. And then another way to go about it is sort of this, me and my spouse are together and we want to survive this system that wants us to get into this box, but it's a very insidious system and it goes so much bigger than us. And it like is really kind of putting us together into these separate boxes. A couple of other ways to go.
Sort of what we were exploring is that like, now that I have reached this like next level stage of life, I feel I need to change and behave a certain way. And in fact, I don't. I am enough, kind of a thing.
Can I pitch you guys something?
Yeah, please.
Zach.
So this may take us on a left turn, but let's see.
Please.
So
hit that turn signal.
imagine we're in this world where instead of there's the Rossum Corporation, it's more like Uber, where it's a marketplace that we can all sign up for and make some extra income. And in this gigified economy, it just pays to be somebody else some of the time.
Uh-huh.
And so the couple, like everybody, and maybe particularly one of the two people in this pair, like really has to do that service and is making their living doing it. And they have a personality, but their future mother-in-law or whoever doesn't really like that, right? So they're trying to shape them using the service that they're also using. And so it's just like, you can go to that place of like, who am I? Like, you can, I think, do the subjective things.
Oh man, like if the mother-in-law hires that person to be like a different kind of daughter-in-law.
Like that, right? Like you could see that, like the gig just keeps paying better and it keeps being other unrelated, seemingly unrelated things. But then it's like, you know, there's like a deal she can't refuse on her wedding day. Like, oh, maybe I'll squeeze it in like 15 minutes before. And then it ends up like she shows up at her wedding as the character and the mother-in-law is like, yes, it's working. It's just this like bizarre sort of like Brazil-esque trip through like somebody's identity just being so fluid because of the economic incentives of, you know, being somebody else. And
well, that's an actor's dream, to be sure. That. That story.
Surprise, surprise. I'm curious if one of you two could sort of pitch the idea that we've developed so far as you understand it. Just I feel like I've lost track of exactly like what we want to move forward on. I don't know if anything.
I mean, we pitched a bunch of stuff and we can move forward on any of it.
I think the basic core of it is before her wedding, a woman is either pressured to or for some reason she decides she has to sign up for a service that either that sort of gives her fake friends that push her into a new life, or the service itself is pushing her into a new life.
Okay.
So it's somewhere in this woman is someone who she likes and she's being pushed to become someone she doesn't like. And maybe there's a temptation there of like, I mean, it still would be really sweet to live in a giant house, you know, like I still think that, but I don't want to move back to South Dakota to do that. So
right.
There's that tension, you know, I don't want to have to compromise on my social and political values to pretend to be someone I'm not to get to live in a big house. Mm-hmm. Capitalism. I think we do still wonder if her husband is in on it or if it's she and her husband against the world. I kind of prefer the latter, but I'm totally open to the former.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The she and her husband against the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I like a paranoid.
I lean towards that as well.
I like a paranoid thriller or a small character drama when you have somebody you can like go against it with, you know. I think that's why I think North by Northwest is so fun, you know, mm-hmm. because
it's the two of them against the world, mm-hmm. right?
If it is the two of them together and the two of them knowingly hire the service, then I think part of it could be that, oh God, you know, we're going back to this small town that we came from where everybody knows us and, you know, we've built our super awesome lives in another place and now we're going to go back and everyone is going to judge us. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait a minute. We could like, if we hire these people, we could pretend to have these totally different, way more awesome lives and show everyone, you know? And so then it's kind of like,
right. Yeah. It's the high school reunion fantasy.
Right. But all the fake friends that you've brought in have all these amazing stories about that time that he went bungee jumping.
Not if you pay them to have boring stories.
Sure.
To make you feel better. I don't know. Sorry, where were you going with it?
No, that was kind of like the end of it. Of like, I can see that also being like a part of it. Of for a moment being genuinely seduced, not just by the idea of having more people at your wedding, but the idea of the person that you can pretend to be by having these people. And the problem is that then 2 months later, the bungee jump story guy shows up and he's like, all right, we're going rock climbing. Let's go. And then you have to be that person and you don't get a choice.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that jogged in my mind is that maybe if this is two people who want to present a certain front to the super judgmental home crowd that knows them like, you know, the inside of a glove, they decide, like, we're gonna sign up for this and, like, go through the training so that we can bullshit more effectively when we get home. And the process of doing that and, like, learning to put on personas and, you know, take on different aspects of themselves, test their relationship in some way. And it, you know, would culminate with whether they actually do get married in the sort of the small town space.
Mm.
It is kind of like a really intense version of marriage counseling, where they're finding out, like, is this what you really want from your life? Like, right. Is our boring life not enough for you? You know, like, so that I think that then the tension is between the two of them.
Right.
But, you know, they are both in it to win it, so to speak. So rather than one of them secretly trying to piss the other off.
I like that. I think that is a good adjustment to make.
How are we doing on time?
You have a little under 6 minutes left.
We're so good.
So how does that then build? Like, where does that develop to? Or what is kind of like the next logical step for something to go wrong in that arrangement?
The reason I'm still kind of into the idea of the bride, the being the main character, is societal expectations for women who get married are still stronger than societal expectations for men. And I think that perhaps where the husband is like going rock climbing and stuff, you know, the wife is like increasingly being dragged into like, you know, we have to go shopping. We have to all
spa
of these.
Day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like not quite Stepford Wives, but like trending in that direction, you know?
Hashtag trending.
Hashtag.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 Gotta make sure that you Instagram all the brunches.
I quite like that. Sort of this idea of, both of them are uncomfortable about being pushed into these spaces, but she's kind of in this place of, but mine is distinctly more restrictive. Like, yeah. I have a tighter box than you do. That is absolutely.
Yeah. And fuck you for enjoying this a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think your reveal at the end of second act is that the people that she's friends with all signed up for this service like she did and have gradually been like boxed into this life. So,
right.
And now they sort of do it because they believe in it and have bought
God.
In.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I think the fear of loss is like, you know, sort of like what is it called? Where you throw good money after bad.
Spent cost fallacy.
Yeah, that's the one.
But I love that idea of, at some point, she finally manages to like lose her tails and like make it out to see this friend that she's been trying to reach. Just kind of this person that like, if I can just get to Janine, like Janine will know what to do.
Right.
And then she gets there and Janine is in the middle of like, I don't know, like a baby shower or something. And she just realizes like, oh, my God, they got you, too. Like you have totally been, you know, Stepforded or Rossumed or whatever we call the organization of just kind of like, oh, my God, no. I thought that you were going to be here and you're over there.
Yeah. I mean, I recognize it in myself as like, we live in a culture where even when people are like, I don't want to have kids, I'm like, yeah, but when are you going to have kids? Like in the back of my brain, you know? Exactly.
Totally.
So, yeah.
So does this kind of end in like a Fight Club place of kind of like,
oh, man,
there then needs to be sort of this like,
like burn it down moment.
Right. If it is kind of something that is like so widespread.
I mean, it ends with the defeat of the patriarchy.
All good stories should. Yeah. And I'm sort of figuring out like whether that means an escape, whether that means, you know, they purposefully act so badly against those expectations that like the people around them quit or something like that.
Right.
Or, you know, whether they move back to the safe haven of a city or something.
I think it, you have to have the third act be the couple comes back together. Like they've been at odds for a lot of act two.
Right.
And they finally have a big argument where they're like, neither of them likes what they're doing. The husband doesn't like rock climbing. He's me, you know, I don't want to go rock climbing. Like, and right. They're like, shit, what have we done? And then they go and, you know, set things on fire, basically. Right. Like, the, I think you do have kind of a gonzo action climax of some sort.
Hmm. Did they go to the, like, headquarters?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could sort of have, like, a sorry to bother you style, like, strike in front of the building or something.
Right.
If yeah. it begins with a wedding, I think that there might also be something to it ending at a wedding. Like, they sort of go to someone else's wedding and kind of disrupt the order of it. But I don't know who that someone is. Huh. Underdeveloped thoughts with a minute and 12 seconds on the clock.
Amazing.
Well, I think if you're talking about...
Or they ruin their own wedding if this is happening like right before they get married. And it's glorious and they sort of burn down the tent and like, you know, ride off...
Yeah,
In the sunset together, graduate style, but without that last shot.
So you could open it with like the engagement party.
Right.
Yeah.
And then end it with the wedding.
Right. And you know what the Twilight Zone ending of that is?
Hmm.
They get, you know, arrested because however many people got hurt when they, you know, set right. the building on fire. And they're kind of ready to be like, hashtag worth it. I love you. And then the corporation gets them out of it because they're kind of like, a couple of people saw what you did at the wedding and they're very impressed. They would like you to hire, they would like to hire you to
oh,
be their
no.
friends.
Oh, man.
And to
oh,
sort
man.
Of, you know, live out that like punk life fantasy at like their side.
Yeah, the ending almost has to be that the corporation has also co-opted this like awesome
yes.
rebellious style.
Like, right. Because capitalism.
Exactly.
Wow, that's dark. I really like it.
And on that note, that is time.
Oh, man.
Amazing.
Wow.
No, I am very...
What a great, great bad idea, Gabriel.
No, and I'm very, very impressed with how far you guys were able to run with it. Like, all the way to the burning down moment at the end. That was awesome.
So where can I hire this service now?
Yeah, right. We'll tell you during okay. the break. We'll hook you up.
All right.
And speaking of which, we'll be right back.
Hello, dear listeners. We're breaking into the episode with a quick announcement for you. We, the three of us here at No Bad Ideas, have a terrible idea, which is many of you and our family and friends and our guests even have asked us, when are we going to write one of these crazy ideas that we've come up with as a feature-length screenplay? And the answer is actually insanely soon, probably, if you want to support us. We are currently $33 away from our goal on Patreon, where you, our dear listeners, support us in producing this show with financial contributions for every episode. Right now, you can sign up to get a bonus back half where we answer a listener question every week for $1 per episode. And for $3 an episode, we'll even throw in an extra Blitz edition of the game that we play in the first half of the show. So you can get basically a full bonus episode every week to fill in that void of extra bad ideas that you might want. And if you sign up in the next couple weeks and we hit that $150 per thing on Patreon, we're going to work with you guys to pick out which script we want to write and we're going to make it happen. It's going to be disturbingly insane. I don't know how we're going to get it done, but we're going to get it done with your support. For everyone who's already signed up, thank you. And for everyone who's considering it, nobadideaspodcast.com/support. Thank you. Now back to the show.
All right, and we are now back with our wonderful guest star, Mr. Todd Vandewerf.
Yeah, I went outside and ran around the block a few times.
It was very impressive.
Yeah.
And we are now into the back half of the show, which is a chance for us to have a little bit more of a free form, free range conversation about whatever is on our minds right this moment. And the thing that is, I think, on all of our minds is Arden, which is the show that you are working on now and yes. which you co-created.
Yes, yes, yes.
What is Arden about for anyone that isn't fortunate enough to have heard it
yet? It's about everything. No, it is a...
See, you make that joke, but it kind of is in certain ways.
It is a fictional true crime show, which like five people just shut off the podcast right now. Like when I have that conversation with people, there are people who are like, true crime. But it is a fictional true crime show. It's kind of a parody and kind of not. It is about a missing woman named Julie Capsom and two women, a detective and a journalist, start up a true crime podcast to try and find her. And then over the course of 12 episodes, they delve into every aspect of the case. And it does reach a resolution in season one, which I will not spoil. But it does end, and we're now working on season two, which will be a different case.
But with the same characters?
With the same characters. Okay, it's great. Going to be, we have our regulars. They're going to investigate a case a season. That's our sort of our procedural model. But yeah, we're going to be doing a different case with a different framework. And we're kind of exploring the idea of each season, the case kind of dictates the genre.
Sure.
Which I Sweet. Think, so season two is going to be a little bit darker, but we also want it to be a little bit weirder. So it's going to like split in different directions. It'll be fun.
Great. And so let's talk a little bit about what it was like to create this show. Sort of where did the idea for Arden come from?
Right. That was me listening to a lot of true crime podcasts.
God bless you. Then,
and going, the world needs more.
Well, I was trying to fall asleep. And this was the summer of 2016. And then I was also listening to some of the really early, not really early, but some of the first big prominent audio dramas. I prefer to use scripted podcast, but audio drama seems to be the term of choice. But I like Limetown especially.
Sure.
I was like, this is a show that is really interesting. And I think there's room for a true crime version of it that is also an homage to the TV show Moonlighting from the 80s. So it's a little bit more playing around with genre, playing around with people arguing, playing around with romantic comedy. I took that to Chris Dole, who I'd done a number of scripts with in the past, and he really liked it and sort of started pushing that ball up the mountain. I kind of forgot about it. and then we brought in Sarah Golub later on because she is far funnier than either of us. And the three of us wrote almost all of season one. There is one episode that's written by myself and my wife, who is my regular writing partner. That is by far the least funny episode of the season. So, though there's funny stuff in it.
I think that there's a recurring trend amongst podcast origin stories of one person going, oh, here's an idea. Let's forget about it. And then giving it to someone and the other person being like, no, let's not forget about it. Let's make this.
Well, one of the things that happened was I took it to Chris and we like wrote this pilot that a lot of it still exists, but we threw out a lot of it because the pilot was a little bit more like...
We don't know anything about
this. No, not at all.
The pilot was a little bit more like conflicty with... Bia, the main character,
sure.
had created this show, and then this billionaire came in and like stole her dream away from her. And after the 2016 election, like there was just like a lot of raw emotion around that, and we were like, how can we find a way to make this less triggering, yeah. for lack of a better word. And that took us a little bit to be like, and part of what helped us land there was originally the character of Brenda, the detective, was supposed to be played by a man. But when we were in casting, we kept finding pairings of women we liked. Hmm. And we were like, let's just do it with two women. That ended up sort of being what got us to a place where I don't think you would listen to that show and think about the 2016 election. God, I hope not. Like,
did not cross my mind. But, yeah. But I feel like we were sort of midstream with Wolf 359 when that happened. And it definitely, like, I don't think it shows up in the writing or in the episode at all, but it definitely was prominent in our thinking about how we went forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of, because of that, this is the thing I was thinking about yesterday, as I was waiting for a train. The last time I was here, I was trying to break an episode of a TV show. My wife and I are in the process of trying to sell. Mm. And I was in the train station listening to the same song I was listening to perpetually in October when I was here. Mm-hmm. And I still haven't written anything of it. But when I was here last time, I had it all broken in my head, but I never wrote it down. And like, as I was listening to the song, I was like, here are all the things I remember. I know I don't remember everything, but these are the things I needed. And I think that the same thing happened with Arden, which was we put it aside for quite a while. And when we did that, the stuff that didn't belong fell away.
Yeah.
And the stuff that was core was there. So I'm a big believer in like setting something in a drawer if you can. Obviously, you can't always do that. But like now with Arden season two, we're like on a schedule and all this stuff. So we have to produce in a more reliable manner. But when you can, set it aside. And 4 or 5 months later, like what you need will still be there.
So I want to get a little bit more into the details of that. So how do you go from, how do you specifically, not like the proverbial you, but how do you go from here's an idea to here is an episode break that I like? Sure. Kind of what is, how do you begin to tackle something like that?
I do a lot of work listening to music and just walking around. Like I just, and images will suggest themselves to me. Story beats will suggest themselves to me. Now, in terms of the TV show my wife and I are doing, or Arden, like that's a little easier because the characters are there. I know who they are. I have a good sense of them. I know what they do.
Right.
Like my wife and I are working on a pilot right now. That's a lot trickier because you could go all the directions. You don't have that.
Which we experienced a little bit in the first half of the show as we more than anything struggled to kind of decide which direction to take the idea on.
So I think kind of my strength as a writer, which I think that people who work with me would both attest to and say is maddening, is I can be like, okay, I know this is the where we're going to end. I know this is a thing that happens roughly here. Like I can see little bits and pieces of what the story is. Yeah. I don't know necessarily how we get between them. Like, and 9 times out of 10, the thing that I pitch is going to stay locked in where it is. But a lot of the time we have to like reconceptualize some of what we're doing to get there. An example of this is when we were doing Arden, the first day of recording, we brought in Lindsay Zanna, who is the actress that played the missing girl, Julie Capsom. And she was phenomenal. And we just had her doing some throwaway lines. And I was just like, we can't waste this performance on throwaway lines. And I was like, we got to do this. And Sarah and Chris were like, we already have this whole back half of the season planned. And I was like, but we need to give this woman a spotlight episode. However we do that. And I'm not going to tell you how we did that, whether she's alive, whether she's not, all of that. Like, you will see how that worked out. But we eventually just sort of ended up tearing it up because like, I think that for as irritating as it was to do, they both saw, yeah, we need to give this woman a spotlight episode. So like, I attribute that to myself, but also Lindsay Zanna was brilliant. So like that became necessary.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm. Now you're juggling Arden with being the critic at large at Vox, and you published a book. How do you write so much?
Well, the book, fortunately, was a bunch of stuff I wrote years and years ago. Edited down.
So really do put it in the drawer.
Well, it was, you know, it was on the AV Club where I used to work. And we were randomly contacted by this publisher who was like, I'd like to do an X-Files book for the 25th anniversary. And I love your reviews. So obviously I had to write some new reviews because they did a new season in the time between that, making that deal and publishing the book. And we had to rework some of the old reviews, but it was a more manageable workload than you would expect from a nearly 500 page book. Like it was a lot of editing, which was, you know, not fun, but certainly doable. And then most of what my workload ended up being was tracking down people, interviewing them, getting the quotes that sort of form the new material of the book, which is interviews with people who were connected to the show. And then there's, you know, my day job is like, I probably write 3-4 articles a week. I write really quickly.
Yeah, you said 3-4 so casually. Yeah. And that's
a lot. Like I think that one of the reasons I write really quickly is when I started at the AV Club, I made my money as a freelancer and they paid per piece,
sure.
But they didn't have a real budget. So you could make up money in volume. And there was a time, one fall season, when I was recapping 15 shows a week.
Oh my
God. So I was doing roughly 3 per night. And they were all 1,200 to 1,500 word articles. So I just had to kind of crank through it. And like, those muscles are absurdly overdeveloped.
Sure.
like when Game of Thrones is on, and I have to write probably a 3,000 word recap right after the episode, I can do that in about an hour, give or take.
Wow.
And so like that is absurdly overdeveloped. Now, as a very specific skill, like it doesn't necessarily help me if I'm working on a script and run into a story problem. But I know where to go to try and tackle it in a way.
Do you find those overdeveloped muscles are ever at conflict with your fiction work, or is there, I guess, how do the different writers in you relate to each other?
So this is a question I get a lot, which is, in fact, a lot of people who don't know that I write creatively, or at least didn't know before Arden. Now,
would you say you're more known as a critic than?
Yeah, I'm much more known. To the degree that when I checked into my hotel the other night, the guy was like, Todd Vanderwerf from the AV Club. Not anymore, but
sure.
Like the muscle they share in common is just doing it, like just sitting down and doing it. If I really need to write something, if I'm on deadline in either side of my life, like. Yeah, that muscle's there. I have a lot of writers, I think, struggle with that. Mm-hmm. And I do need some sort of deadline to make it really work, but it's there. But the two types of writing are very different to me. Like the critical side of, I think of it as a left brain, right brain thing. The critic stuff is very left brain for me. It's very much like diagnosing something. It uses my right brain to help because a lot of it is drawing on like, not what would I do, but like, what is my knowledge about this from having tried to do it. But then like, I don't want to step in and say, no, Steven Spielberg, you should have done this. Cause that's not like, that's not my place. Like that's not what a critic is supposed to do. So it is a little bit more like being giving a diagnosis than it is, trying to come up with becoming your own doctor in a way.
Yeah.
Mm. And then the creative stuff is like, this is a thing I really struggled with. I had a sort of a mentor who was like, you got to learn to shut off your inner critic. And I'm like, I don't have one. Like this is not me saying that I never think what I write is shitty. This is me saying for a lot of people, their problem is when they're sitting there and writing, they'll be like, oh God, this is terrible. Like that voice is in there because it's so cordoned off in the left brain to talk about other people's shit.
Totally.
That like, I sometimes can get really far down a path and like not realize that if I was critiquing this, I would be like, this is a terrible idea, you know?
Right. I think that we all sort of have like our own methods of separation of kind of those parts of our brain.
Yeah.
I know that I definitely sort of feel that the strongest when drafting, kind of page by page.
Right.
And the moment that it is either the outline is, or not the outline, the draft is over and I can go back and read it, I sort of breathe a huge sigh of relief of just kind of like, no, this has problems. This is going to get better, but right now it's fine. Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, when it's all in the outline, I can sort of read and go, Urbina, you've done it again. My God, brilliant word after brilliant word in this outline.
See, I have the exact opposite thing where like when I am drafting is when I feel good about something, when I'm just like doing it, then I that like takes so much of my mental energy that I don't have time to think about the quality of it. And immediately after I'm like, what the fuck did you just do? Like, how are you going to show this to people? This is such a bad idea.
I will say the few times it's happened to me where it has become so bad that I can't keep working because my brain is like, this isn't working. It's right. Like,
sure.
It's a situation where I have written myself into a terrible corner and I need to start over. But That happens pretty rarely. Not to say that I'm like great or anything, just to say that when it comes time to just spew words on a page, I can do it like forever because I wrote 15 recaps a week in 2009.
I feel that with us, if the outline works, I don't think that we've ever run into a situation where we had to. Well,
no.
I was about to say something that was untrue, because exactly one time we actually wrote out a full script and then realized that it was broken.
Yeah,
but I think that like more common the experience for me is I'll write an outline, and if the outline if I don't feel good about the outline, if the voice is there nagging me, that's when I know. No, there's something broken here.
And sometimes you power through and are just like, I know that this part of the outline doesn't work. I need to write it first.
No, we can fix it. The version of powering through is I give it to you and then you come back and you give me a look and I go, I know.
And
I'll go back and fix it.
We didn't really outline season one of Arden. We just kind of winged it. And
well, season one of Wolf was similar. Yeah,
like we obviously we had kind of the signposts. We knew here's where we're headed. Here's what's going to happen. In between, we're just going to have fun. And like it worked, but it worked by the skin of its teeth. When we got together after season one to be like, what didn't work? We had all these places where it should have gone wrong, where we either were saved by the actors or by like a last second writing save where we were like, okay, that's going to fuck everything up. We need to twist it 15 degrees.
Sure. And you have some terrific actors on your show.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Michelle, who was also on Wolf 359, is one of the leads in Arden. Yes. And Michelle absolutely sometimes saved our writerly asses. We gave her something that should not have worked. And she kind of went, no, I've got this.
I was astounded by, in the process of casting that show, Michelle and Tracy, our two leads, we needed them to have chemistry. I was astounded by when we had them read against each other in those roles. Because first we had Tracy read Bia and Michelle read Brenda, which was a terrible idea. But we had them read against each other in those roles, and it just was like, oh, there it is. Like we heard it right away. And then how easy it was to write toward that.
Yes, that's another thing, is that once you have a voice, like then it not only knowing the characters, but like knowing that Michelle has got this. Mm-hmm. It makes it so much easier.
I think that this is actually bore out one of my theories about TV criticism, which is I think casting gets you season one. It's writing that gets you all the other seasons. You can fuck up as much as you want in season one if the casting's right. And there's so many shows you can point to where like Glee, for example, their season one is kind of a mess, but the cast is so good. You're like, okay, sure. But if you don't have the underlying writing work, structural work done, seasons two and later on, people are just going to eventually turn against you.
Wolf 359 definitely supports that theory.
Whatever do you mean, Albina?
So I don't want to just ask you, where do you get your ideas? No. But I'm curious, since you said that Arden was written without an outline, kind of where did the concepts for each episode, where did you find those? How did you decide these are the adventures that we're going to send these characters on?
Well, I mean, it started as a very straight true crime parody. Like it started as a very straight, this is the episode where we do this trope, which is they go on the drive to recreate the final voyage, which is a true crime trope. I think that's our weakest episode. I wrote a lot of it, but it's like literally, there's not really a reason for it to exist. There's good stuff in it. It's also 55 minutes long and should be like 35.
We don't know anything about that either.
So like when we started those first, I want to say the first five episodes are all like, we're going to explore a different aspect of the case every week. And like when you look at our listenership, like there are a lot of people who listen to the pilot. There's a lot of people who listen to episode two, but a smaller number, which makes sense. A lot of people will hear a pilot and say, this is not for me.
Right.
And then there's kind of a similar number that continues to episode four. Everybody who gets to episode four tends to finish the season, but you got to get them there because episode four is when we kind of turn it and just a little bit are like, okay, now it's about the characters more. And once it becomes more about the characters, then we follow through. But we're hiring a writer's room for season two. So I just got, right before I came here, I interviewed a bunch of different people.
Oh, wow.
For a role working on the show and hearing what they have to say about season one and where they thought it went right and where they thought it went wrong, like, has been really fascinating. And like, we've gotten some interesting substantive critique. But in the second half of the season, I think we just sort of intuitively felt the story here is more the characters and this mystery they're trying to solve. And we had kind of an idea of how the mystery would play out when we started, which sure. I think helped us. Like, we had a pretty firm idea of what, at least one or two of the big things that had happened. But we revamped a lot of it on the fly, and it still worked somehow. But I attribute a lot of that to the acting, and to the fact that I think we nailed the ending. Mm-hmm. I'm not like, I think our last four episodes are our best four episodes. And, that's always a good place to be in.
Yeah,
for sure.
Cause I think the three of us now feel we know how to write the show too, which is giving us more confidence. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm curious why you are opening up, a room. Is it just because you want to do more, have more episodes, or are you looking for, additional perspectives and sort of on the fly things now that the three of you sort of have a sense of things?
Part of it is season one was a punishing amount of work.
Sure. That's very fair.
We found out later on that most audio dramas / scripted podcasts do in their first season like 15 to 20 minute episodes. And we were like, we're doing a TV show.
Let's go.
So like, our shortest episode is 39 minutes. And that's the first episode.
Which, hey, we applaud the hubris of going for it.
We didn't realize it was hubris. You know, like actually when we wrote the scripts, they were all around 25 to 30 pages. We were like, a page a minute, but we wrote them in a Google Doc.
Nah.
So it was probably more like 1.5 pages per minute.
Right.
Yeah. Like 0.75 pages per minute. There's the math.
Right.
And yeah, it really, we had the punishing amount of work. The other thing is, one of the conceits of the show is each season is loosely based on a Shakespeare play. Not yes. based, but very connected to. And we're doing Hamlet in season two.
Oh my.
And Hamlet is big and dark and weird and scary.
Yeah.
And not only are we doing Hamlet, but we're doing it about what if Hamlet was a woman? And there's a lot of landmines there. And so we already want to bring in my wife because I like writing with my wife and because she is a really big advocate for mental health. And that feels like a thing you need to have if you're doing a version of Hamlet that takes place in 2019. But then we were like, what else do we need? So we wanted to bring in not just different perspectives, but diverse perspectives. We wanted people who had really different thoughts on what the show was going to look like and all of that. And I think we're going to end up with a 7-person room.
That's awesome.
We are like paying people way less than they're worth, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it. One nice thing about having three co-creators is we can split up in three. I'm running pre-production and Sarah is running production and Chris is running post-production.
That's
and
great.
Maybe that will all fall apart. But we learned from season one that what sort of happened, which was just all of us just did whatever we could, was not the way to work it. Because it ended up with like Chris frantically re-editing episodes the night before they were supposed to go out.
And oh, yeah.
Just, yeah. We all kind of were tired of it by the end. So
it sounds like a good lesson learned sort of building.
Yeah, we're building processes, which I'm...
Which lead to better problems.
It's very adult of us, I think, which I'm surprised by. So, yeah.
All right. And I think that is where we are going to have to say good night for the time being here from No Bad Ideas headquarters. But before we do, we want to thank Todd once again for being here. It has been such a pleasure and so exciting for us.
I really loved being here. I really loved learning about hiring friends. I'm going to start doing it. Can I plug like 15 things?
Yes, please.
So I write at Vox.com. You can find me on Twitter at TVOTI. Arden is available on your podcatcher right now. It's a good deal of fun, I think. Season one is
I think so too.
I'm super proud of it. You can also find us on Twitter and various other platforms at Arden Pod. I have a new podcast coming out in April from Vox Media called Primetime. If you've heard of the podcast, you must remember this. It's You Must Remember This, but for TV.
That's great.
That's amazing.
Our first eight episode, first season is called The President is on TV. It's about the intersection of presidential politics and television. Wow. I'm really proud of that. And you can also buy Monsters of the Week, the critical companion to The X-Files, in bookstores now. I'm also proud of that, surprisingly. So
check out all of those things. The things that I've seen out of that list are awesome. The things that I have not seen, I am so excited to see in the near future. And yeah, go and do all of the things.
Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at patreon.com/nobadideas. And if you love the show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks. See you next week.